Thank you. Thank you very much, also for the very kind invitation to come here. It's really a fantastic place. I mean, I arrived last evening, so I haven't seen everything yet, but I'm already very impressed and stunned. I want to speak here about experiments in which you enter the regime of strong correlations, and as you see in the title, both in traps and lattices. Actually, in traps, it's an experiment where the system is not even condensed or just about to condense. But before I come to the outline of the talk, I would just remind you of the development of the field of cold atoms. Of course, in a simplified picture, it started with laser cooling, and then it took off with the realization of Bose-Einstein condensation, a weakly interacting system. And immediately after the realization, a fantastic series of experiments has been conducted in vortices, superfluidity, matter wave interference. And I think at that time, even the most optimistic person wouldn't have expected what then happened. And what then happened was almost an explosion of the field. And in particular, the field moved into the strongly correlated region. And there have been demonstrations of molecular BECs. Of course, quantum degenerate Fermi gases were realized, optical lattices were introduced, the BEC-BCS crossover was seen, low-dimensional system, and I could make the list even longer, and the list keeps growing. And sometimes I have the feeling the list grows so rapidly that we have, it's difficult to keep up the pace at which the field continues, and we are not looking maybe sometimes carefully enough at the systems that we have. So we move on to the next system, and we have not completely got all the aspects or even sometimes very exciting aspects of the existing system. So in this sense, I will talk about two topics. On one topic, I will revisit Bose-Einstein condensation, and maybe with an emphasis on condensation, so on the phase transition. And in particular, I want to look at the critical behavior of a trapped interacting Bose gas. So that was the trapped system in the title. And in the second part, I will speak about these new systems coming up, about quantum gases in optical lattices, in particular about fermions in optical lattices, also about molecules, and shortly about Bose-Fermi mixtures in optical lattices. So let's start with Bose-Einstein condensation. So if you think about Bose-Einstein condensation, maybe one remarkable thing is that on the phase transition itself, not so much work has been done. So usually, the way we look at Bose-Einstein condensation is that we cool our cloud, we get the condensate, and then we switch off the trap, and the cloud expands. We take these absorption images, and we see them on our screen. And when we cool down, we see this fantastic, nice, thick cloud, which is always excites experimentalists when they set up a new experiment. Of course, this bears a lot of information, actually, about the gas. But another important step was, of course, Wolfgang Ketterle's experiment, where he showed that clearly showed the wave nature of the Bose condensate, and that you could see these interference fringes. But you could still ask, what is the characteristic of a Bose condensate? And the characteristic there, you may go back to Penrose and Onsager, and they argued, and also independently Landau. I mean, you need to have a condensed state, you have one eigenvalue of your density matrix has to be macroscopic, and then you can write your density matrix as a condensate.
I never known Landau argue.
I think Landau argued, well, that's, I mean, I did not read the original text,
well,
but...
Well, here's the water parameter, right?
Yeah, so... Well, not so we can.
not in the sense. Well, I continue, yeah, that's right.
Okay. Anyway, and then you have the condensate plus you have the fluctuating part. And they're already, I mean, this nicely describes the condensate, but you can already see that if these, it's getting interesting if these values both are on the same order. So if you have extremely small condensates or whether even it's just about to condense the system. And the argument of them was that if I take this, I will call this first order correlation function, and you look at two points, and if you go further and further, and then this density matrix will exactly go to the condensate fraction. And one may now wonder whether one can measure that, and actually it turns out with quantum gases one can directly measure this first order correlation function. So maybe a quick look at optics, so, or first a quick look at this view graph. So, in a more simplified picture, if you have a thermal gas, this first order correlation function falls off like a Gaussian exponentially, and with a characteristic length scale of the thermal de Broglie wavelengths. And if you have a condensed system, then you have this correlation function falls off to a plateau which shows a long range order. And if you would want to measure such a function in an optical system, you may think of a double slit experiment. So the distance between your two points is a separation between those slits, and you might look at the interference pattern. If you have coherence, if you have a phase coherence, and you see an interference pattern, and then you may move your slits apart and further apart, and then if you still have phase coherence, and if you're infinitely apart, you still have phase coherence, that would correspond to that you still have condensate. But how can you introduce that in a Bose gas experiment? And of course it's not the nicest thing to put slits or variable slit constructions into this UHV setup. But what you can do is you can create virtual slits. And I do not know how familiar you are with atom lasers. And that comes actually these virtual slits from atom lasers. So the idea basically is you have your quantum gas in a magnetic trapping potential. And so at different positions, and in particular due to the gravity, it's more the atoms more or less feel a gradient along the cloud, a magnetic field gradient. And now you shine in a radio frequency, a weak radio frequency. And then at a certain shell, more or less it's a horizontal plane, there you induce your resonance with a magnetic transition. So you can drive a transition from a magnetically trapped state into an untrapped state. And that you can do in a very well-defined position. And if you take two frequencies, you can do that at two frequencies. And then you output couple from two regions, and what you expect then is to see an interference pattern, if you have a coherent system.
Regions are not two points, you're saying it's a
two planes. Mm-hmm. Yes, two planes. It's like, I mean, a slit, I mean, there you also have, well, usually you take slits, double slits, and not point sources. Yeah. Okay. So this method now gives you a way how to test, and by simply changing the frequency, you can change the slit distance, and of course you can change the temperature of the cloud. And some time ago, that was still in Munich, we did such an experiment, and we could measure the first order correlation function. And you see here two thermal samples. These are the yellow dots and the blue dots for different temperatures. And this corresponds to a gas which is described by a thermal de Broglie wavelengths. While when you have a condensed system, then you see that the first order correlation function falls off to a plateau, as you expect for a system which shows long range order. And now one could, of course, ask how does this correlation function of the thermal gas, when you cool the gas, how does this go over to this long-range ordered first-order correlation function? Will one be able to measure the first-order correlation function as you go through the phase transition? Yes, sure.
Can you get like these lines, are they just fits or is this clearly?
Sorry?
These lines, like
you thought, these are fits. I mean, they are, okay, these are Gaussian fits, and these are Gauss plus an offset, which is not completely correct, but that's a fit. Yes, one, and then one could get here more precise, yes. I think that at some stage, you see you have some inhomogeneity in the system and so on. I think at some stage, Sandro Stiringari wanted to do that, but I don't know whether he has. I mean, that's some time ago. I'm not sure how. Okay, but I think the question one could ask, can one see how this first order correlation function, how this behaves right at the transition point, right when the, because here what you see, I mean, you have nicely see the situation when you have a condensed system, and you nicely see the situation when you have a thermal system, what happens right at this transition point. But when you look at this experiment, the way we did it there, the news is sad, because you need to go very close to control the temperature very well and go very close to the transition point. And as you see here, we extract our information from these output coupled beams. And we couple so many atoms out that we have completely changed the system. And that would never have been able to get information on this transition. Yes?
Why the temperature, the force temperature, is just 290
Kelvin? Why? There's a different particle number. And then you have a different transition temperature, and it's, yeah. It was just to compare. I mean, you see that this falls off more slowly than at a similar value in the condensed system.
So what do you call a disability? Is it an interference?
That's the interference, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Another question. Presumably this constant is just the superfluid fraction, which you can measure separately.
Which you can measure?
Separately, just by seeing like how much of this, sort of, you know, the central peak, like, you know, this double peak structure. So do they agree?
You see, the problem with the superfluid fraction is always you have underneath, you still have some thermal stuff. Yeah, no, but that with the fits is it, there is it's always difficult to get. I mean, if you wanted, I mean, I remember, well, I need to recall what were the discussions at that time. I mean, if you want to exactly get the density distribution in a sense of having a normal fluid and a superfluid, and to look how the shape is in the trap, that you have to put theory into it. And that was always Stringari, he always wanted to, how can one separate those two components. That was
okay, but even with naive theories, right, we know how the condensate fraction should change below TC. So does it match?
Well, I think what Tillman's saying is that I may be wrong, but I thought you were saying you want to go beyond the theory. Suppose I really want to look at the fluctuations, all those theories, now it's assuming there's a condensate and then a thermal tail which is completely plausible.
Yes.
Would be incorrect. I think the question, how much that you want to get close to the
Okay, but
at that time it was kind of the, I mean, if you looked at it, there might be a superfluid and then there might be other density of the thermal one underneath, and it's difficult to distinguish between those. You see whether it might could be like this. But here, I mean, here the main point of this measurement is that you see the correlation function, and it shows exactly the shape that you
want to make sure whether it's just, you should look at it as a qualitative plot or whether we have complete quantitative.
Here you should look at more qualitatively, yes, because no one has done a quantitative theory.
But would you understand that visibility is proportional to the number?
Oh, yes, 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 yeah. I will. it goes with the, yeah, whether it's exactly proportional. That also depends on the geometry and so on. So I'm a bit reluctant to say it's exactly proportional. But I completely agree with the point of view.
So the way you create these double slits, these effective double slits, you focus where you should be.
No. The atoms are simply in this magnetic trap, and if you include gravity, that causes a sag. So you, the center at the minimum of your magnetic trap may be above your cloud. Because, I mean, you have this harmonic trap, and then the gravity pulls it down. And that means that if you now plot or think of the contour lines of the absolute B field of your magnetic trap, these are shells, and which are almost horizontal at when they cut your tiny cloud. So you have to think of these magnetic field line shells, and now you match your radio frequency to do spin flips exactly at these positions. Yeah, sure.
You mentioned that in the condensed state, this profile is a constant constant.
Yeah, I'm plotting only up to here. I mean.
Yeah, but I guess in the condensed state, the Goldstone mode may be the power of the case.
Here it's a power. Yeah, this is yeah.
It's a constant plus power.
Yeah. That's this little. But we could not. I mean, that's why it's a thin line.
Yeah.
Because you see, it fits nicely, but we could not claim it has to be this fit. But completely agree. Yes. Okay. But anyway. The bad news is that with this method where you output couple most of the atoms, you will not be able to get close to the transition point because you change the system too much.
This is also kind of a interference pattern, right?
Yes.
So, but for catalytic experiments, we know that this first order interference doesn't mean superfluid, like a real coherence between particles. If only you have a lot of particles, then
I mean, you can, of course, have an interference pattern with the thermal cloud. Is that what you are?
Oh, so
but here, the shape, I mean, you have this.
CERN is a catalyst, so interference between independent condensates.
Yes.
Okay.
That was, okay, okay. It was actually one of the referees. I think it was Tony Leggett's concern. and he said, yes, okay, all fine, but couldn't there be two separated regions? And that, for a moment, it caused us concern, because right out of the experiments, it was difficult for us to conclude that. But then we realized that our data, I mean, what does it mean? I mean, this if you had an upper compartment of the BEC with a certain phase and a lower compartment with a different phase, that would mean that your interference pattern would be shifted because you have different phases. And so for the 1 kilohertz data, where we have slit separation corresponding to 1 kilohertz, we realized that we triggered the experiment with, I think, with 2 milliseconds. So that every second run, we had exactly the same phase. And that, from that we could conclude, yes, we have data which shows that it's the same phase.
But I think if you average over enough time, right, so the point is that Ketterly made just one shot experiment. If you average over enough time, then the interference pattern averages out to
then it would go away. But that was you see usually it would average away, but it did not average where we kind of output coupled on each run with the same phase. But you see, if we hadn't, if the whole experimental run wouldn't have been triggered as a multiple of the 1 kilohertz, then our one kilohertz source would have gone out of phase with the rest of the experiment. So in that sense, we were lucky that we had this data. I mean, another way was to look at three, if you output couple from three places, there you can also exclude.
So the data, you did average over a number of experiments, but they all were fixed phases in the way that you talked about?
Yes, yes. Okay, so shall I move on? Okay. So it's difficult with this approach to access the phase transition. So if you want, if you would think, okay, well, if one could nevertheless access the phase transition, and actually to look into this more closely, that was stimulated by a visit of Anatoly Kuglov, who told us, who had a suggestion, who came to visit us, and Matthias Treuer in Zurich, and he told us he has a proposal how to measure the critical exponent for the 2D superfluid MOT insulator transition. And this, so he talked about this proposal, and during talking about that, he said, oh, the critical exponent should be exactly the same as one of the BEC 3D transition, not the quantum phase transition, but the thermal transition. So that triggered that we looked into it more deeply. And then secondly, I was at that time lecturing Bose-Einstein condensation, and there usually I bring these plots, and then we were discussing a bit more closely what is happening at the transition. And then I talked to Tobias Donner, who was also attending this course, wouldn't that be a nice project to see with our new apparatus, which I will tell you in a moment, to try whether we can see something on this change of the correlation function right at the transition, and then to report every week in the lecture on the measurement, so that the students see how these things evolve. Anyway, during that time we also learned quite a bit, of course, about the phase transition. Intuitively, of course, it's clear that you have, at some stage, this condensate has to build up its long-range ordered phase, and initially there might be patches with one phase pieces pointing face in this direction, elsewhere in the other direction, and that right in the transition you would have large fluctuations of the order parameter. And then, of course, with many discussions also with Matthias Treuer and other people, we learned, and some of you probably know much more about that the Bose-Einstein condensation is so-called XY model, kind of where you have a continuous phase, and of course you can describe the behavior right at the phase transition universally by critical exponents. And for example,
you're probably going to address that in a moment, but size effects, trapping potentials, all this.
It's all tricky, yes. It's all tricky, but we think in the region where we measure, it's not dominant. That's the conclusion we came
because my feeling would have been that to determine phases, it's great, but to determine critical behavior, maybe atomic systems will
be less. Yeah, but the size, over which we measure, is still small compared to the whole size. The corrections so far, we have not input on what the corrections should be to our measurement. The correction due to finite size might be that in the center region.
That's the main point. I have no doubt that you measure on a small region. That's not.
Yes, there might be.
Behavior is gone.
Okay, we can.
I know maybe you are saying that there's a way to reveal the critical property large systems for small distances by looking at short distance behavior. If that were the case, that would be very remarkable. But
Of course you have. There's a certain distance where we do not measure anymore. But within, the question is, how does it behave, the system, within this distance?
And again, the size is large enough, there is no reason why one not define a critical exponent. I'm just wondering how small is smaller.
I see this.
Is there approximation of the correlation length is bigger than the size of the system? We can no longer measure any But then the second part is that the potential is parabolic, and that might take extra care.
I'm less worried. Less worried about the finite size. Of course, on the scale that we measure, but on the harmonic potential, also we have not yet input that should matter too much. We'll see. Okay. But let's have a look at what is the picture that emerges for the first order correlation function at the phase transition. So usually the picture that one has in mind with the Bose-Einstein condensate here is here the condensate fraction in green, and here you have the transition temperature, and here you would have, here on the right-hand side, you would have first-order correlation function Gaussian shape, and here would, like this Penrose-Onsager, gradient level off to a finite value. But now let's zoom into this region very close to the critical temperature. And there, the picture is the following. So here you have horizontally the temperature axis, but this is all very close. And what you can measure, in principle, with the output coupling is this correlation function. And so the blue curve is this correlation function, and the correlation function you expect close to the phase transition to go like this, 1 over r, 1 over distance, times exponential minus r over correlation length psi. And this correlation length is now plotted here as a function of temperature on this back sheet. And this correlation length diverges as you go close to the transition temperature. And the way it diverges should be universal, and this universal critical exponents usually called mu it goes like T. This is a reduced temperature, kind of the distance from the critical temperature, times minus nu. And this nu is a critical exponent of the correlation length. Okay, so one can now look at nu in the literature, and then one finds, of course, there have been actually experiments in Santa Barbara been done on helium. And in helium, what people do in helium when they look at the lambda transition of superfluid helium, it's in the same universality class, but it's much higher density. They look at second sound measurements. And then they can determine, I called it here nu tilde. Usually they call it a xi, but I didn't want to use xi because my xi is a different one here, so I call it nu tilde, and due to a theoretical argument of Josephson arguing that superfluid fraction is the coherent fraction, then this nu tilde is equal to the nu, and with their second sound measurements and also space-borne measurements, so they did quite a lot of effort, so more than of course we could do, and they get very precise values for this new. But these second sound measurements, that's not a possibility for the condensate. So we have to do another approach, and one can wonder, okay, what would one learn, or if one does such an experiment in a weakly interacting Bose gas, I think one nice aspect is that you can then directly measure the new through the correlation function, not through the superfluid density. And of course, it would be a confirmation of universality in the sense that the density, the system is quite on a different density scale. And for quantum gases, of course, a new type of measurement when you actually get numbers out. And in the context of quantum simulation, or when it's quite nice exercise to go through to try to get actually numbers out of your system. So what are the challenges to do this experimentally? One challenge is you need to go extremely close to the critical temperature. And you need a temperature resolution well below 1 nanokelvin. At least as a distance, not on so much on the absolute scale, but at least you need to know how far away you are from the transition point. That is where you need to have this temperature resolution. And it requires, for the experiments, a kind of a new level of precision. So the way our experimental approach is done is, one could ask, what is the best possible temperature resolution that you get? And there is one limitation is, of course, the heating rate. And for our experiment, and when we tried to reduce it, we were at 4 nanokelvin per second. So one has to make sure that you look on time scales, on fairly short time scales, relatively to this 4 nanokelvin per second.
What they come from? The shaking of the trap?
There are three body losses. There might be residual atoms hitting the cloud. There might be a little bit shaking of the trap. We, of course, try to minimize.
So you can measure temperature by measuring time.
This, you see?
The starting temperature.
Yes, but there you can very nicely see when it condenses in the experiment that we have. So you need to be reproducible, and you see you need to be, the reproducibility is very important, that on each run your experiment does exactly the same, but you can there very nicely see whether it does the same, in the sense of once it condenses you get a big flux of atoms in the detector. I'll talk.
What's the temperature of Bose condensation to compare it
to? That's 148 nanokelvin in that case. Yes?
Maybe you address it, but one problem is, so you have to average this correlation function over time scale to
yes.
the order of this half a second or so. Now, when you get close to the critical point, you need to re-average over a very long time. So is it long enough to determine correlation length because of critical scale?
Well, that one has some heating rate and some dynamics in the system.
Even if it was not heating, not dynamics, just the fact that you're averaging over some finite time. Just your averaging was heating.
Yes. So but then you always have the heating, then I don't know.
Yeah, so suppose you want to measure a correlation function, and you really measure a correlation function. The correlation function is a static property.
Yes, yes, yes.
You're
yes.
measuring over some finite
yes.
time scale.
We're not
really measuring the static correlation.
There is some residual, yes, dynamic. I completely agree.
Because of your measures.
Yeah, but we believe that, because of, that we have a finite resolution, yes, in that sense. We have a finite resolution in our measurement. Okay. And that partly limited by the resolution of the heating rate, but as long as you assume, of course, there might be a little bit of assumption at right at the critical point, your system is changing in time, and we look at time bins while it's changing. But I think I need to, because we had quite a few discussions.
Yeah,
you know,
I remember this discussion. It's a different concern.
But maybe I'll tell more about the experiment so that the others can follow.
Maybe I can make one comment. Probably what you have in mind is that they are measuring the correlation function at two different times. But if the time is short compared to the distance, in proper units, if they measure the correlation function at large distance, then it probably doesn't matter very much. Because what will count is the decay with distance, not the fact that it's short time difference.
I'm sorry, but I think we should have that. I mean, this is an important discussion. I completely agree, but I think so that everyone can follow, I'll continue, and then yeah. Okay. So, of course, also what you, I mean, there are also more, I mean, limitations in the experiment in this sense, because I mean, you can take. As Dimas says, this as a kind of a scale for your temperature, but and then you need to do a continuous measurement. But of course, you still need to measure on your system, and to measure on your system, you have to change your system, and so you want to minimally disturb the system. And the way how we solve that is that we use single atom detection. A single atom detector to measure this interfering beam coming out of the BC, so that we try to minimize the numbers of atoms that we extract from our system and to record our interference pattern. So to do this, we kind of combine two fields. One is quantum degenerate gases and cavity QED. There usually you think more about quantum computing and so forth, but we use that for a single atom detector. And the setup then is such that you have here the BEC, then the atom laser beam comes out, and instead of taking absorption images as shown here, you have this single atom counter using this cavity. So each time an atom comes in here, it makes a click. And this is the experimental apparatus, just to show you that one really needs an experiment for it. And one needs quite a bit of a different approach to BEC than with the other ones, but only shortly. So we produce a Bose-Einstein condensate, and here below, this is where the cavity is mounted. So this, I mean, the final setup, it's of course shifted here to the flange, and then the distance between BEC and the cavity is 36 millimeters. Okay, so what do we see when we measure here with a single atom counter? And here I should point out that was done with a different frequency separation for other reasons. So this time scale is not the time scale we measure on, but just to illustrate you how the data looks. And so this is when these single atoms clicks are accumulated, and then you get data which looks like this. Sorry?
What does the time mean?
Here the time means, I mean, there we did a very low beat frequency at very, very small distances. That was not the measurement we used later, but the principle is, of course, the same. So this time is much longer.
I guess it's just indication, so this is the time.
The time for the beat frequency. This times give you the beat frequency. So it's a very low beat frequency.
You turn on this your coupling.
No, we. Oops. We have those two beat frequencies, and then you see the beat of those two frequencies in your detector. This interference pattern. You see, you have your interference pattern. It's of course falling. The interference in the absorption image, it's just one shot, but here it's falling. So it goes up and down and up and down.
I can think of this coordinate along this.
Yes. It's like a, yeah. Oh, there we folded it. There we wanted to see just that this interference pattern is established.
Because you knew the original frequency that it should come
at. Yeah, there it's just folded data. This experiment was done in another context, but it illustrates how this detector works. Yeah.
So the time is an inverse of the beat frequency, is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so then we...
This time as well as phase difference between the two points.
The energy. I mean, you have the atoms. Those. I mean, if you think of energies, you could also think those atoms or the atoms output coupled at higher have a higher energy than the lower ones.
Yeah,
And now they are coupled due to gravity. And then they, in their time evolution, if you think of solutions, of array functions in the gravitational field, then they have slightly different energy, and that will lead to a beat. And this beat, you see.
So even if they had perfect phase, let's say the phase difference was zero.
Yes, they will still beat, yes, because they have different energy. They are different energy eigens. Because you. Okay, so we kind of then did an experiment where we tried to see kind of whether it worked, and this was more or less the data that Tobias presented then at after 1 or 2 weeks, I don't know, but fairly early actually, and that was at 1.1 TC, and there one could see this dashed line is the thermal de Broglie wavelengths, and the other line is just a fit through.
Another question, so how many outings, like how many atoms do you measure to actually get the interference
path? The way it is run is the following. We produce a condensate just below TC, and then it heats up due to this heating rate. It melts. And during this process, we do output coupling with as few atoms as possible, but still giving us a signal. And then we repeat this procedure. And then we add up enough to get a good signal. I cannot tell you whether it was 10 runs or 20 runs on each. Yeah, we take one slit distance and make many runs, second slit distance, many runs, and then kind of we randomize the slit distance and do the different runs.
And if I take a single run, so
how much? Oh, that would be, there you wouldn't see anything. Or not much. Well, it depends on, you see, then it depends, you could see something if you then take a long time bin. It depends on the length of your time bin that you accumulate your data. And this length of the time bin then gives you the temperature resolution that you have. Okay, so.
Also make many experiments.
Yes.
So
exactly. And then we need to see where we have optimal situation for the amount of data that we have.
How many experiments?
I think it's roughly 10 per slit disk, but I cannot. Yeah. Might be 20. Okay, so there we were fairly optimistic at least to see something, but we need to go much closer to the transition temperature. And what we finally, I mean, by that time the course has already ended. I mean, it was quite nice. We did in this course, when we started with that, we did a little survey of possible outcomes. I mean, when you start such an experiment, one outcome is, of course, you just don't see anything. It's just a rubbish idea. You can forget about it. So that was one possible. The other possible outcome was that you see something which clearly deviates from the thermal de Broglie wavelength. So that we fairly early. So the second outcome where we see some kind of universal behavior in the sense that if we change the size of the system, that we always get the same course. And then the fourth option was that we actually can measure a critical exponent. But it was kind of the distribution equally distributed on those four options. And I cannot remember actually which one I voted for. That's
I.
It's bigger because it's not a condensate. You see, all this data is taken without condensate. That's also an important point as compared to the previous measurement, because once you have a condensate, then it's getting difficult, because then you have all sorts of mean field effects which also affect the output coupled atoms and so forth. So this is all kind of in a third thermal cloud. You can do that above TC, but not below TC. Below TC is more difficult.
Since you've shown show the distance, what do you mean by the distance? Did you fix one point and then vary another?
Symmetrically.
Symmetrically.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a question. Each of your connections, you said you have a couple of complaints. What's the radius of the
diameter? That is, it's negligible. And then we did. Yeah, we did. You see, the thing is that you then have a kind of a point detector down there. More or less, you just get atoms which are almost p equals zero in transverse direction. And we did a kind of a little simulation to.
You average over the entire plane. Then?
Yes.
So you are collecting from the entire plane.
Yes.
So what's the size of this
plane? That is like. That was similar size than the detector. That's maybe 20 micrometers.
So it is much larger than this operation. So I guess
it is larger.
I'm
yeah.
Concerned with the questions.
Depends
on the temperature comes, not maybe from the fact that they are separating, but that you start getting less fluctuation within each plane. Right, because some quite low temperatures, each plane, each point on a plane has the same phase. High temperatures, even the same plane, you have a lot of fluctuation.
Yeah, but you basically, if you look at the 3D correlation function, what basically we do, we integrate our two dimension and we remain with just that one dimension. And due to the fact that we only get almost transverse zero temperature atoms in our detector, which is due to the geometry of our experiment.
I'm not sure I understand. I guess, first I can see that it's not like the usual two-point correlation function,
yeah.
Which I used to in statistical physics. I
yeah.
think what you are saying, it's integral of the two-point correlation functions.
Along, yes, so, yeah, and it remains only what then remains is the one direction,
yeah,
the z-direction.
Integrate, therefore what will be locked is kind of
yeah, I mean you can. I mean one can calculate. I mean there's this calculation by Martin Arashevsky in Reuglaube for a non-interacting system, which is of course not really describing the real situation. But for the non-interacting case, there you can calculate and also then compare take the geometry into account that we have, and there you see that you have along one direction, you're actually just taking the correlation function along one direction. Due to the fact that we only take almost only p equals zero. And that, again, we have checked by looking at for classical particles at a distribution, what arrives at the detector.
Sometimes I have two displays, right, which are much larger.
Yes.
So it's like you're measuring this correlation function, but you also have contribution from correlation function of these points, right?
Yes, but then
all of this.
Yeah, but they fall out. I mean, similar like a double slit in a double slit.
It's different than our two wires because in this case actually you cannot neglect the outward. So the atoms do not go radially, right?
That's
why his point detector only takes atoms exactly in the middle of the plane. So basically it's just the p equals zero part. It's not
p or r.
Not r equals zero, only p equals zero because it's long enough. No, because it's long and it traveled long enough time to real space to momentum distribution to be converted into real space.
To limit this discussion, I suggest. I suggest we postpone the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now, yes.
So the measurement itself, you're saying it detects every single atom,
Yes. Sorry?
So you measure on resonance, the cavity is on resonance?
The cavity is on resonance, yes. And we see a drop in the cavity transmission each time an atom drops through the cavity. Of course, it has to drop through the moat of the cavity, and this gives us a finite detector volume.
So if you did it's off resonance, would you be... I mean, so that would become sort of more weak, continuous measurement.
theory. Yeah, but it does. I mean, there we are just interested to measure that the atom is present, and the biggest, clearest signal is that mode. But yeah, and just to remind you that, I mean, kind of a single experimental run goes along this direction and this direction and so forth. So these are different times evaluated. Okay, so now from these curves now correspond to the correlation function that I showed you in an earlier graph, and which has 1 over r e to minus r over xi dependent. So we can fit this and get a value of xi out of it. And then we can plot the correlation length xi as a function of temperature, as is shown here. And of course, we have fluctuations. And here's again this xi, the behavior. And then we can get fit, out of the fit, we get mu, and we can leave open the precise TC is also in the fit. And well, you can also double logarithmically plot it. And the result, what we get out, I mean, one has to say, I mean, we were not biased at the time when we took the data, we were not even sure what the real value should be. I mean, we were at that moment still learning. So I think, I think we're really not biased, but it looks biased. I completely agree with you.
Let me see the data again. You say you're not biased. How do you get a red curve?
Well, that is a fit. That is the red curve is a fit. That is
a inset.
Well, that is a fit. We take fit to. I mean, we take it. That's a bit more complicated even because we have different time bins, and depending on where we start with our time bins, it changes. So we have to we average over different starting points of the time bins.
And if you fit into the Einstein Seneca form with this, with the one of our divide, and then you adjust the best exponent to.
Yeah.
Okay. Fine.
Yeah. And I mean that we have an error. We so have a substantial error bar. I mean the helium people would say, oh, well, did you measure anything or? Yes.
So is there any special reason to have this, the data not present in the window?
That is there we did not measure. I mean that is. Yeah, it is, but it, you see, it, you could, I mean, the interest, I mean, if you look at the, if you look at the Ginzburg-Landau criterion, then the relevant part just goes to, you get 0.4 micrometer, so it's roughly here. So that is the part where we... We take them in the fit, but we also check, so it does not, I mean, it does not change the result. I mean, we checked if we cut here. It gets a bigger error bar, but it doesn't, but then it, in principle, I mean, the thing is, from an experimental, but from the experimental point of view, you see, there you, the question is, of course, okay, if I put in a lot of theory, then I would take this part only. But then I put in a lot of theory. So what we did is we took our data and then we checked whether it changes. But it did not change. Of course, the error bar gets bigger. So then we thought, oh, well, let's leave it as we evaluated, kind of with a...
How big you'd expect the fluctuation region to be?
Sorry? It's here. This region.
Actually, how much does your
For a homogeneous. I mean, that doesn't take into account the trapping potential. There's no theory on that.
Actually, if I look at your data, like this insert, right, that's supposed to xi as a function of temperature. So it looks like if you put it away, I would say it actually makes your fit worse.
Right? Yeah. Here you fit worse than there, maybe yes. Yeah, but the error still. I mean, it simply. Well, all we could.
By the way, the fact that you have such huge error bar. Close to the transition might have to do with something that I told you before.
I mean, we have this, the point, I mean, we take finite time, bins. And where to start, we cannot decide. So we averaged over all starting points. That's how we did it. The cloud size, that is maybe 50 micrometer or so. So it is substantially larger, the cloud size. So it, we should not be limited by finite size, but potentially by harmonic trapping potential.
Well, things are still very impressive in the first round, just after one quarter.
It's the same but a larger error bar. It didn't change. It did not change. It did not change. That we made sure because of, yeah. Okay. So that one can, yeah.
So the procedure is that you just measure like clicks in your caddy, yes. Like NFT, and then you just take your relation function NFT and NFT plus.
Yes, we need, yes, yeah, yeah, roughly, yes. Okay, so for non-interacting homogeneous gas, you expect nu equals 1. For non-interacting harmonic trap, you expect 0.5. Interacting mean field, 0.5 renormalization group theory. But we were, I would have preferred to have an 80 or so. So they didn't. But. And, well, these space-borne experiments, they had incredibly precise values. I mean, it might turn out, it is a bit scary, of course, coming out with such a number without having a detailed theory. So it will be exciting to see.
I mean, in principle, you can measure alpha by putting in energy and look at the change in energy to take the cloud size and then by measuring specific heat energy,
yes.
And compare with the...
Yes, but different. Yeah. We had to operate in a regime. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you can just tune the Fischbein resonance to make the.
Oh yes, that would of course be nice, but for rubidium it's difficult. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Because there you don't have a good Fischbein resonance.
How hard is it to do an experiment where you look at the way that interference fringes, the contrast changes with temperature, from which you could presumably extract alpha. As long as the coherence has a small consistent sign.
Sorry, I didn't get. The alpha, that alpha?
That alpha.
There was some, I mean,
sorry,
that.
Alpha.
Sorry? But that is incredibly small, that alpha there.
No, I mean the could have experimented for correlating for phase space.
Yes?
The correlations in one body density.
Yes?
So that would give you the visibility of interference fringes.
Yes, yes.
Whereas you will
think. That's also new.
But that.
Yeah, well. Okay, but would that be an easier or harder experiment to do?
I think, I mean, the way we did it is the easiest,
I mean,
possibly.
Instead of looking at some spatial variation, just look at how the contrast increases and infer the way that the correlation function decays as the increase in the contrast doesn't
matter. But the increasing as function of?
As temperature.
Well, but that's what we measure. We measure a two place and then look at the temp.
How this varies, whereas if you do the whole cloud at once and then infer the way that the correlation has varied.
But we have to do many, many measurements anyway. We cannot do
No, but all the cloud at once, I think one of the problems is that there is no one single transition. Because of the interactions, the transition basically creeps outward from the middle and it's just a crossover. So the only way to see it is just to look, focus on a very small part of the cloud, I think.
But
yes.
You can do a couple parts, the cloud, and then look at the interference and integrate over some region.
Yeah.
Right,
okay. Okay. That we can. So. So, but I mean, I'm probably much over time. So it really, are you still need coffee or I don't know.
Before you move on, can I ask again my question on inhomogeneities in the system?
Yes.
Because the liquid helium experiment is very homogeneous system.
Well, the gravity.
So
well, okay.
Is there any idea?
There is not enough
to avoid the gradient of density. So is there any idea or theoretical control?
No.
Change in density induced by the
I don't know, but I mean, Jora looked at that, but we have no feedback from him on that he has a calculated a correction. Well, I told you. Well, sorry, I'm sorry, but I heard that. I mean, I do not know how delocalized Jora is, but if he's localized, he's not so far away localized from your office. That much I know. So it's not an absurd question.
Can you imagine PC, then distribution of exponents, okay, all the nasty effects that we
yes.
have 7 here, not to be a 7?
Yes, I'm not, that's why I say I would have preferred an 8.
No,
yeah, but we have an error bar. I mean, you have to read the whole number, and there is an arrow bar, and it's pretty the same size as the other. So that's
I think that finds the correlation function should be a power loop. What happens if you try to extract this power from your data, like as approaching the critical point? Could you obtain the correct power loop?
I do not
the
see.
The correlation function is an exponential.
Yes, it is.
Be a power loop.
Yes, I mean, and we approach, yes. And that's what we measure. More we cannot.
What happens if you have tried to extract this power from your from your points that you have from your data point?
Well, I think we cannot more.
You put 1 over R.
Yeah, we would 1 over R, yes, but we cannot. I don't know how else I should do.
Teaching the beta to 1 over R to the power beta and extract beta.
Okay, yeah, we could, but okay, we thought we'd do, well, the fitting that we did. So. Okay, yeah, but we need to be at the critical, you see that?
Okay, but as you approach the critical, it's better.
Yeah, we can, okay.
Can you move on?
Okay. I move on now, okay, but we can discuss everything. Okay. Okay, so I'm just get a little bit to shrink. I'll be back in a second. I need. So that will all be recorded. This is awful when I drink. Okay. Okay. So let's now have a look, and I will be a bit try to be faster here now. And so the quantum gases and optic lattice, in principle, it's a rather a simple experimental concept. I mean, you take these ultra cold clouds, and then you expose it to 1, 2, or 3 optical lattice beams, and which produce this periodic potential, and then you create this way your system. The nice thing about these optical lattices is that by varying the parameters or changing the system slightly, you enter in very different areas of physics. So of course there are these quantum phase transitions, then there are there are low dimensional systems, you can look at dynamics in these systems, and of course you enter regions where you have almost ideal or very good realizations of condensed matter systems, and just by changing parameter you go to different physics region, also few body physics, of course. So when you look back at the idea where it comes from, this optical lattices, that actually goes back to an idea of Letterkov in 1968, so that's not so long after realization of lasers, and he wanted to use these standing waves to avoid the Doppler widths, to kind of trap the atoms and to do a very good spectroscopy of it. The principal idea behind is that the standing wave induces a dipole moment, and then depending on the detuning, the atoms may be attracted to the intensity maxima. And so then you can think of, if you put an atom into such a standing wave, if you put it with low enough energy, might oscillate in this potential well. And that it took some time to realize this proposal, that is simply because the potential heights, if you take reasonable laser power, goes just up to 100 microkelvin or a bit higher, depending if you take a lot of power. And that was, of course, at that time not available. The first rounds of experiments were done then with laser-cooled experiment in optical lattices. But there, the shortcoming was that you only very few lattice sites were occupied, so kind of every 1,000th lattice site, and they were not in the ground state. Of course, then with Bose-Einstein condensate, first in 1D lattice, I think Markasevich did the first experiment in this direction, and then in two and three dimension, that opened rather a wide field. And in particular with three dimension, you need an experiment in a way that is designed for optical lattice, because you need the optical axis in all three directions. The way we do it is this concept here, and this is kind of showing you the naked experiment for to see more clarity. And what we do here, this is a region where we magneto-optically trap both rubidium and potassium atoms. Then we have a magnetic conveyor belt to put the atoms here into the region of this glass cell. And there we evaporatively cool the atoms so that we have a quantum degenerate cloud of, typically 1 million up to 1 million rubidium atoms and potassium atoms, 100,000 with temperatures. Well, we are now at quite a bit lower than 0.2 T Fermi. And then you can apply lattice. Here's shown a two-dimensional lattice, but you also can apply a third beam in this direction. And you need this good optical access here in this glass cell. That's an important point for the experiment. And then you can shine in a laser beam and say, depending what your sample is, you can get this type of absorption images. Okay, so this is all with all the optics around. So the glass cell is here inside there, inside this box, and that's where the lattice is. And I think it is always important to remind one that you have this periodic cubic lattice potential, but in addition, you have the confining potential. So, for many aspects, I think it's a very important point, the confining potential, and we cannot just neglect it. And typically, the distance between the lattice sets are half the wavelengths, and you populate, say, 100,000 lattice sites, and depending on whether you have fermions or what type of atoms, 0.5 to 3 atoms per site, there's also flexibility on this. So if you look at the optical lattice, the simplest way is, of course, to look just at a single lattice site that can be approximated by a harmonic oscillator. You put an atom in, and this is a well-understood system, probably the best understood system in quantum physics. But even when you start with two in, it's getting interesting, because for bosons, you can both put in them into the ground state. But if you have fermions in the same internal state, they due to the Pauli principle, they will not want to go to the same state. What makes the things interesting is interactions. And if you have two atoms, they may, via their scattering lengths, interact repulsively or attractively. But already there, I mean, if we put three or four atoms in there, that's getting complicated. And two atoms, it's nice. But more atoms, it's already kind of non-trivial few particle physics. But then, of course, in the lattice, we have many of these potentials, and the atoms can tunnel between them. And this picture, one would more think of a band structure. And the band structure picture is very nice if you have non-interacting system.
When you said 50 nanometers, that's the individual well Raman capacitor?
Yes, yes, okay. Yes, yeah.
And how many sites do you have?
And you have 100,000, and depending on the aspect ratio.
And what is the potential like, the overall potential, the overall traffic ratio?
That is, well, depending on that depends on the lasers. They can be fairly round, but that can be have a ratio 1 to 2, or that depends on.
Just to switch off the trap, between the Bunsen
lattice. Yes, that you can do, but then of course your stuff leaks out. I mean, you could take a blue detuned optical lattice there, your ground state is slightly bending the energy outwards. Then you could of course try to compensate this and so forth. That is, well, the thing is, this is all possible, and I'm sure we will see more of engineering of these optical lattices. But even just producing a very good high quality 3D optical lattice, I mean, it sounds simple. I mean, taking three beams and overlapping them, it sounds really trivial, but it's very difficult. I mean, when you align them, you take your atom cloud. I mean, they have to be at the position of your atom cloud, and then you shoot your laser at the atom cloud and see whether your atom cloud kind of symmetrically expands after shooting at it, just to make sure that you are well aligned. And if you then think about box shape potential and so forth, that's all possible, but it's a challenge, yes. And in that sense, I don't know. Yeah. Okay.
And so, this is usually turned on. We have a cloud, it's condensed, or?
Yes, we have the cloud condensed or a quantum degenerate, and then we slowly ramp up. And then we may slowly ramp back, for example. I mean, there we recently did some measurements to see how much we heat for the fermions. I mean, you go into the lattice and then go out, and then you measure what temperature you have afterwards to see how adiabatic you are and how much heating you do.
So this ramp typically takes place in the condensed state as opposed to...
Yes, 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 yes. Because otherwise the cooling in the lattice is not obvious. There are proposals, but it's not obvious. Mm-hmm. Okay, so band structure is nice, but also very nice is if you take into account interactions and that you realize that one can use only the ground state, where it's all atoms, one can prepare them such that they're all in the ground state, and then you can consider the atoms as hopping from one side to the other. And of course, then you can see in two dimensions, you can consider them hopping, and maybe another atom should come now. Yes. And that hops further, and then they collide. And this, of course, the usual way to write it is this way. And I think it was actually this idea, I mean, in this famous paper by Dieter Jaksch, Christoph Bruder, Sirac, Gardiner and Peter Soller. I think this idea came up some years ago on some Santa Barbara workshop. Is that true?
Santa Barbara, yeah.
Now it sounds, of course, simple, but I remember when Christoph Bruder, where's Christoph? Christoph was sitting there, yeah. When you told me in Konstanz on this, there was a workshop. And then you kind of, that was the first time you told me that one should think of the atoms, they're hopping. And I think at that time I was concerned whether the parameters were really right or something like that. You had presented a poster there. But anyway, this simple but backwards it sounds simple, but it was a big breakthrough. And of course it opened the whole field that one realized these atoms in optical lattices are Hubbard models, or can be described very well by Hubbard models. And compared to condensed matter systems, the nice thing is that you can change all the parameters. I mean, you can change the tunneling simply by changing the intensity. That gives you access to dimensionality, because if you have suppressed tunneling in two directions, then the atoms can only tunnel along one dimension. Of course, you can also change the geometry. I mean, not much has been done there, but it's obvious that you can take other angles. And it's all challenging, takes time, but possible. You can also add this order. First experiment, this direction are going on. You can change the interaction using Feshbach resonance. You can change atom number. You can do most of the things time dependent, so you can do that in time, changing things. You can change the statistics, and even change the statistic in situ if you go from take fermionic atoms and make bosonic molecules out of it, and you can look at multi-component systems. So of course one example is this superfluid MOD insulator, and that you know. So I go on to the fermions in 3D optical lattices, and one nice motivation is, but that is really, I mean, a very tough, is that maybe one day one might be able to answer this phase diagram using cold atoms. But it is hard. I mean, this is hard. But my feeling is it needs one more kind of big breakthrough. I mean, we have seen during the last 10 years many breakthroughs, so we should be optimistic that there is another breakthrough. But one needs some breakthrough to get to lower temperatures, or other clever idea, or I'm too pessimistic. But I'm not pessimistic, but it's not around the corner, it seems to me, but maybe...
Sorry, the naive question, but what's the difficulty? I mean, so you're doing with boson, the fermions are just more difficult to cool?
Yes, and you need extremely low temperatures there, in the lattice. And it's not clear how you cool in. If you could cool in the lattice, would be nice. But, I mean, going into the lattice and back out, you increase the temperature. I mean, kind of typically we go in, say, with 0.15 T over T Fermi, then we go out after the procedure again in the normal trap, then we are at 0.25 or so. Into the lattice, 0.15, say we go in, and then we come out by 0.25. And that, I mean, of course one can optimize it all, but maybe also there is a clever idea. I mean, that I think that's the two possibilities.
So what temperature do you need to get?
I think that would be, I think it's at least one order of magnitude lower than what presently is. Well, I mean, yes, okay, the antiferromagnet, it would be the first big breakthrough, and then one can realistically start to talk about the other, but that's, again, lower temperature.
So where does prediction come from?
That prediction comes from here and here.
Do you mean the main problem is the temperature?
I think the main... Well, the main obvious problem, I mean, of course, if you solve one problem, then you face the next problem.
How long have you been that you try to do this problem, give a power to a higher thing, so that's not
a... Sorry, if you?
If you give the interaction, you have a fixed line resonance.
Yes. You can, of course, but there are limitations also concerning losses, basically, if you for the repulsive side, mainly. Okay, so...
just a second. I pointed out that graph was on 2D optical, well, 2D.
2D, lattice. Yes, but that is fine.
The final offset 3D.
Well, yes, you see that, but that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. To realize a 2D Hubbard model, you need a 3D optical lattice because you increase the intensity along one direction.
But this is a 3D, it has like a graphic delay in 3D model.
So, I think it's not a big contradiction. I can live with that. Okay, and I go now to the more easy case of non-interacting fermions, and let's see what is happening when you load them into the lattice, and then one way to characterize them, or the way to characterize them is, of course, the Fermi surface. And with atom systems, you can actually look at the Fermi surface, and the idea here is that you load your system into the lattice, and then you're in this situation there on the left-hand side in a tightly confining lattice. And now you adiabatically ramp down your lattice in the sense that you do not have transitions between the different bands. and then you map this quasi-momentum distribution on the free momentum distribution, which you can measure. And that way you can measure a projection of the Fermi surface. So if you have only few atoms in your lattice, then you would expect a spherical shaped Fermi surface, and then if you shine light on it, then you see a shadow of this Fermi surface, and that's what you can measure. So this is a half filled, or a bit less than a half filled lattice, and then here it's almost lowest band is getting increasingly more filled, and here you have a filled lowest band and a higher band. So this shape, I mean, simply due to the Pauli principle. You can also look at that just within the lower bands and compare it with simple non-interacting calculations. And there you can go kind of from a conducting state to a band insulating state. But of course, the interaction which make the game fun. Yes?
Question,
yes.
Slide.
No.
What is the weird interference that...
You see, yes, that is a good question. I think this is an extremely good question, because these are the problems we have to fight day in, day out. These are, well, I think these are electronic interference. I mean, they're on the camera, some electronic interference with other electronics while readout process. And well, but that is, I mean, you see, one can, of course, make, I mean, they are not too bad. I mean, you could make these images nicer by looking kind of, you can take this part of the image, take the Fourier transform, and then filter out. One could, without being mean to the data, you could do that. But it's really the type of problem, and there you see also, here it goes a bit up. These are optical fringes, slightly.
But you say essentially this has nothing to do.
No physics in it, but lots of work in it to minimize and get rid of it, yes.
In what sense are they non-interacting?
Sorry?
In what sense are they non-interacting?
Oh, they are, well, if they were just one spin polarized species, then it would be easy to answer. But in fact, in this experiment, there were two spin up, spin down. But via Feschbach resonance, the interaction was tuned to zero. We had to go that way because otherwise you cannot cool. I mean, you need them cold. So, yeah, to make them non-interacting, you have to go to the Feschbach resonance.
You
tuned
it to zero.
To zero. Yeah.
After you cool.
Okay, and. That is also the nice thing about the fermions or potassium, also lithium, that you have a nice Feschbach resonance available. And well, basically, I'm not going into Feschbach resonance now. You have the magnetic field, which you can tune. I mean, this is a reasonable value of magnetic field, and here you have the scattering length. I mean, one has to be a bit careful here. This side here. There, on the right-hand side, that I would call easily accessible. And then I would draw a line, say, up where it ends here at 1,000. And then this left-hand side, again, would call easily accessible. But then here, when you go over 1,000 or 1,500, then you have losses, and that limits your experimenting time, heating rate, and so forth. So one has to be a bit careful in the sense of saying, well, one can tune everywhere. That's not
so. How much logical really. for very low occupations like 0 and 1 on the average? I'm supposed to mean you have 3 particles per side, then you would have loss, and also your high temperature. But
yes, it
I
might.
I just want to find out the numbers. Or suppose you go to optimize it in the lowest temperature possible, and then 1 or 2, or at 0 and 1 particles per side.
I mean, to maybe deviate the answer a bit from your question, but there might of course be these losses might be very nice if you can prepare states where you don't have the losses. even though, I mean, just avoiding three particles on one side or taking this as an indication of a certain state. And there it might very well make sense and one can see something, but yeah, one has to precisely work it out how.
If you put three particles on the left side with infinite steps in it, what is the right
one? I cannot tell you. I don't know. I think you calculate them, or you. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, it doesn't live long when we write on the resonance. It's after the experimental and the 10 milliseconds or less. Yes, less. I mean, we were limited here on these measurements, which I show you. Well, I'll show you the measurement in a second. There's a limitation due to this lifetime.
Why is this not a problem for meeting?
They are usually here then in the bound molecular state on the positive resonance side. And lithium suffers less losses. But why exactly, whether there's a very short answer, I don't know, some molecular shape. But usually, I mean, there is also not easy to access the repulsive side. That is, I mean, lithium, the nice thing is you can get to very low temperatures, lower than in potassium, but usually always stuck with an attractive scattering length. Because on the repulsive side, you always have then the molecules. Maybe one finds a trick, and that might be one of the tricks where you can make big progress with some molecular coupling, and that's why I also think that the few particle physics is very important in this for progress in the field. Okay, so but when if you look at Feshbach resonance in lattices, one has to take care, of course, with the Hubbard model, because if the scattering length is larger than the harmonic oscillator length, then you have to take into account the higher energy levels. And that's been some work been done and an experiment we did, and often a good approach is just to look at the minimum tunneling limit, and there are solutions for two particles on a side. And let's see what is happening if you increase repulsive interaction. So that means, let's say, on the Feshbach resonance, we go up there. I need to tell you what this is. So these are the energy levels of two particles in a harmonic oscillator, where the scattering length here, the zero, is in the middle. The Feshbach resonance is on the outsides. So, well, maybe if I go back. So you start almost non-interacting, and then you go to repulse if you go over the Feshbach resonance, and then you end up in a different level, and you should have populations in higher bands. And we looked at an experiment doing this, and we could indeed observe population in a higher band. But this experiment was also, in a sense, limited. We had to go very rapidly over the Feshbach resonance, and then there are different adiabaticity criteria that you have to meet, and then you have the three-body losses, so it's not so straightforward.
So how stable, what's the latest news, how stable the system is when you go over to the
In the transition, it's not stable. Over, once you are on the other side, it's fine. That's fine. Yes, that's fine then. Uh-huh. Yeah, but yeah, one has to think more.
Can you tell with the insulator there? You start with band insulator.
We have not done yet more. It's interesting. No, I think it's an interesting question. Okay, if you go along the Feshbach resonance in the other direction, then you can create molecules. And you have here two kind of regimes. One regime where you go to here from positive scattering to the attractive one, then you have an attraction, and the particles you might have kind of preformed pairs. If you go over the Feshbach resonance, then you have real molecules, I mean, real weakly bound molecules which survive when you switch off the lattice potential. Those on the attractive side, they do not survive when you have the lattice potential. And you can look at these molecules, at the energy and the shifts using radio frequency spectroscopy. And the way it then looks like, I mean, here you have non-interacting, then you get this signal. And if you have, say, a bound state or two atoms on a side rather than bound state, then you get a peak. But to show you the difference, I mean, there you have, I plot here two regimes, but really one should probably plot four regimes. So on the left-hand side, that is scattering positive, scattering length positive. There you have real molecules, and they survive when you switch off. And if you drive the radio frequency signal, then the total atom number, if you dissociate, then total atom number seems to increase because you no longer have to break the real molecules. At attractive interaction, there you just shuffle around from one state from 7.5 to from -7.5 to -5.5, because the atom number that you detect when you switch off is always the same because they do not survive. And why I say that you should have maybe another regime in there is, of course, if the question, when is the are the two particles, the attractive particles, when are they form they do they form bound states, or when are they just happen to be on the same side? Okay, and you can measure the binding energy and the number of molecules that you can create. From that, you can get some measure of the temperature, and there we have, compared to earlier experiments, or these experiments increase now to more than 60% molecule formation. I think I go very quickly over this now. Because we can, no? Take my time? Really? Okay. I mean, I'm okay. If it's fine, I mean, it's, I need some water. I'm sorry, I'm very dry now. Okay, so now I'm fresh. So, okay. So, Bose Fermi mixtures. Okay. One motivation is, of course, that the system of helium-3, helium-4 mixture is very interesting, and one can see a depletion of the condensate if you admix helium-3. And one can also think of polaronic physics and also Fermi-phonon coupling in a sense of that usually in a lattice it's not so trivial how to input phonons, but there one can think in a Bose-Fermi system so that the Bose condensate gives you a linear energy spectrum to which the fermions can couple. And also one can think of composite Bose-Fermi particles, if say you have attractive interactions, that you have composite particles of Bose-Fermi. And the experiments which we looked at and also similar experiments done in Hamburg, they are done at a certain scattering lengths between the atoms, which we could there not change. And of course, more once we can access this Feshbach resonance, I think one can get a clearer picture on this Bose-Fermi mixture. But anyway, the basic idea of the experiment is a rather straightforward idea. I mean, this is here I plot NF divided by NB, number of fermions divide a number of bosons, and you look at the optical lattice. And so this is obviously no fermions in your mixture, and you see an interference pattern when you rapidly switch off the lattice. So it's just a Bose system as you know it, and this is just below, a bit below the superfluid mod insulator transition. And now you add the fermions.
Potassium is polarized.
Sorry? Yes, you are one in a particular spin state, yes, yes. And then you see that the more you add the fermions, your interference pattern vanishes. And kind of the transition or where you lose your superfluid, this point goes to a lower value. But you can recover also the interference. So you can do the similar experiments like in the Bose-Bose mixture.
In the Bose. This picture is only bosons or both bosons?
We look at the bosons here. At fermions, there are fewer fermions and they're not, so we could not see something exciting. There it's the same, yes. But there it's much fewer and more difficult the signal. And there is not, we did not see immediately exciting things happening in the Fermi picture. We looked at the fermions as well, but not so much change
what
we could see.
Potential for potassium, how different it is from the...
The numbers. Here are, and on the, there will be another slide also with the number with the hopping, which is, of course, important. So here with... Well, that is, I will come to that as well, yes. The effect, why this is happening is not really clear. I mean, there are interesting suggestions. So we have 10 to 5 bosons and, this... U over J is 4.8, so this means at the superfluid mod insulator would be at 6, so we are below that for these pictures. Okay, what one can now look at is at the visibility as a function of the U over J. And the black curve, that is the pure bosons, and there you see at 6, there should be the transition. A bit later, you see an increase in the width. So where this means you lose your coherence. Here, you lose your coherence. And if you add the fermions 10%, then you lose your coherence earlier. And if you even add more, then you even lose your coherence earlier, even earlier. So the conclusion from this data, I mean, whether you look at visibility or coherence length, the behavior is similar. The conclusion is, okay, the presence of the fermions leads to depletion of the superfluid or the coherent fraction. I'm not saying because. I mean, I've just said what from the data, what you can put the conclusion from the data is simply you lose your interference pattern. When you lose your interference pattern, a good argument is that you use your superfluid fraction, you have less particles with a long coherence length.
What is the interaction between bosons and fermions?
That is attractive, and it's twice as large as a Bose-Bose. The fermions are much lighter, so they are hopping easier than the rubidium atoms over the lattice.
But what is the number?
I have to look it up.
But can you change this number?
That is, one can change this number, and one can even change the ratio. You see, that's how I applied for a titanium sapphire laser, you see, because it's interesting to change the relative tunneling, but therefore to do this you have to change the frequency, and the only laser which is suitable for that is
So you can do that when you get too close to the, let's say, to the resonance.
Well, there are regions where you can do that. I mean, it's reasonable. There are reasonable regions.
You change the frequency, wouldn't you change the periodicity or
either one? Yeah, you will also change the group, but he now also gone back to France in Orsay, and several PhD students, which some of them you might know. Okay, so I thank you very much for your